Good morning, my friend. May the 4th be with you. Happy Star Wars Lisping Day, I guess. Glad to be back with you for a second hour of the program today. Hope you're doing well. Here in about 15 minutes, going to be talking to my guest, Andrew Flowers. Andrew, who writes for the website 538.com, which is, I think, currently now started by a guy by the name of Nate Silver. It's one of my favorite websites because it looks at a whole host of different things. Of course, we've had Leah Labresco on a number of times, Leah, who writes for 538.com. And we've had Mr. Flowers on before on a different topic, on the issue of sports, which 538 is also now an offshoot of ESPN.com. So we talked with him about the college football playoff. But today we're going to talk to him about economics and an article that he had just a little over a week ago. What would happen if we just gave people money? Under the section called economic policy, and he deals with the idea of what's called universal basic income, this radical proposal, which has been around for some time, but which has gained some steam, it seems like, lately. The radical proposal to unconditionally guarantee citizens an income. And believe it or not, and we'll let Mr. Fowler talk about some of the people who are behind this idea, some of the objections, of course. But one of the things he says is it's really got quite a diverse group of people who are backing the idea. Part of it is rooted in the frustration over the bureaucratic myriad of different social safety net programs and the sheer expense and unwieldiness of managing that and of just eliminating that and streamlining the whole thing. Others very concerned about economic insecurity in a world of increased automation and where there will be fewer jobs. How do we keep people from economic disaster and really from internal despair? So we'll get into all that with Andrew Fowler. And listen, if you've got a skeptical question, maybe email it to me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or you can call or text 573-4-BREAD-4. But as I've said before, what I appreciate about 538.com is it doesn't just dismiss ideas based on gut feeling, which we all tend to do. We hear an idea, and before we really consider it on its merits, we reject it out of hand. Oh, well, that's communism. Instead of really letting an argument stand on it and stand or fall on its own weight. So we'll talk to Andrew Fowler about that here in just a little bit. Toward the end of the program, we'll spin the Dollar Catechism wheel, of course. And I'm asking a question of the day on the 46th anniversary of the shooting at Kent State University that left 4 unarmed students dead and 9 others wounded after National Guardsmen fired over 60 rounds in 13 seconds at a time of great turmoil and protest. Captured, of course, in an iconic photo of the young 14-year-old Mary Ann Vecchio leaning over the body of a slain student. What do you think is the most powerful photograph in U.S. history? 573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text. Email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. Back to today's reading, first reading, which is St. Paul in Athens, really his first, I think, major missionary journey. And he is there engaging the polytheistic Athenians. As the broader passage is, the one maybe leading up to the one in today's reading in the Mass in Acts chapter 17, it says, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he grew exasperated at the sight of the city full of idols. You can only imagine as Paul, not only, of course, a faithful and devout Jew who has now become a Christian, who still passionately believes, of course, in one God, monotheism, which historically is what set the Jews apart from all the pagan religions around them. And so here he is in this country that is completely given over to a belief in a multiplicity of God, full of idols. As you can imagine, he would be ready to do apologetic battle, to really nail these people He spent time debating in the synagogues and with the worshipers and daily in the public square with whoever happened to be there. Some of the philosophers, Epicureans and Stoics, were interested in engaging him, and they said he's got some ideas worth hearing. And so they took him and they led him out to the Areopagus, sometimes called Mars Hill. It was sort of a public square forum where ideas could be discussed. And they say, may we learn what this new teaching is that you speak of. Now, here's where I think your appreciation, our appreciation of St. Paul has to really grow. It's in his remarkable restraint. As we said, St. Paul, a very driven type A person. It was he, of course, also known as Saul, who was out to arrest Christians because he saw them as corrupting the faith. He was not foreign to the idea of blasting one's opponents, and he could have done that here. Now, I think there's a lesson for us here, because I think sometimes we have a tendency to want to do that in this sort of, in our frustrations in what is increasingly a post-Christian culture. We find ourselves frustrated because our viewpoint now seems to be in the minority. We see this rise of the nuns, of those, and I don't mean N-U-N-S, I mean N-O-N-E-S. We get those who claim no religious affiliation. We see this rise in a different value system. We wring our hands. We predict the demise of Western civilization, all the rest. And we're ready, if given the opportunity, to blast people. We are. We have this tendency. And sometimes it's rooted in a virtuous thing, a commitment to the truth, a zeal for the truth. But what we oftentimes miss in that is such presentations of the truth rarely persuade others. They make us feel better. The choir, or those who support our point of view, they pat us on the back and applaud us, but it has very little real power to persuade. And St. Paul, given this opportunity finally to speak his mind to all these idolaters, takes a very different tack. He says here in verse 22, then Paul stood up at the Areopagus and said, "You Athenians, I see that in every respect you are very religious. For as I walked around looking carefully at your shrines, I even discovered an altar inscribed to an unknown god. What therefore you unknowingly worship, I proclaim to you." Now look at the transition that has taken place in Paul. He was exasperated, could barely contain himself. Now, when he preaches to the Athenians, he speaks to them, he begins on their own terms. He sees in them the good, the God-shaped desire planted within each one of them, as the Catechism itself tells us that human beings are incurably religious. Even with the rise of the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, even though their impulses, they may not define them as religious, they are religious in their very nature. There is a hunger for the transcendent in every human being. God has wired us for himself. And St. Paul begins not with the issue of confronting, but with persuading. And that persuasion is not a fake thing, okay? People read through that in a heartbeat. It is recognizing the dignity of the person, and that just because they have not yet embraced the Christian faith doesn't mean they are entirely wrong. That there are degrees and shadows and shapes of truth in all these belief systems. And it's really about finding those points of common ground and helping to help people to open their minds and hearts to see how what it is that they believe is pointing them to something more. And St. Paul goes on to say, "The God who made the world and all that is in it, the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in sanctuaries made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands because he needs anything. He made from one the whole human race to dwell on the entire surface of the earth, and he fixed the ordered seasons and the boundaries of their regions so that the people might seek God, even perhaps grope for him and find him, though indeed he is not far from any one of us. He goes even on to quote not from Moses or from Isaiah. He quotes from some of their own poets and writers. He quotes, "For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your poets have said, for we too are his offspring." I think this in many ways is part and parcel with the opening of the mission of the early Christians to include the Gentiles, not just the Jews. It involved a recognition that even among the Gentiles, even in the non-chosen people, truth was not absent. The hunger for truth was not absent. It was present. And I think St. Paul gives us a great model here of how we can engage a culture that has a multiplicity of other gods, that even in its sometimes frustrating value system, there's within it some kernel or desire for a greater truth. So I think St. Paul is a great model of a persuader, not simply a confronter. Maybe we'll get back to that at the end of the show. But we're going to talk to Andrew Flowers next of 538.com. What would happen if we just gave people money? We'll find out. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this Wednesday, May 4th. May the 4th be with you, as they say. Anyway, pleased to have on the program today Andrew Flowers, who is a quantitative editor for 538.com, writes on sports and economic issues. I'll confess from the get-go, I'm a bit of a 538.com fanboy. What I like about the website is how it presents arguments and lets the arguments stand or fall based on their own merits, not on preconceived straw men and all the rest. And Mr. Flowers here with a very interesting article, very thought-provoking, and I'm sure raises a lot of questions. What would happen if we just gave people money? Talking about the idea of what's called universal basic income. Mr. Flowers, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Love to see this very, very interesting article. Tell us, what is universal basic income and how long has the idea been around?
Well, universal basic income is an idea that is as simple as it is radical. The government would, instead of administering different social welfare programs, it would instead just cut everyone a no-strings-attached check, so no conditions. You're rich or poor, doesn't matter, you get the same amount of money. You're employed or unemployed, doesn't matter, you get the same amount of money. Now, it's a radical idea. It sounds very it's very interesting for two reasons. One is it seems very left-wing or progressive, but it actually has a pretty broad ideological appeal, believe it or not. There are people on the libertarian right, who really like the idea. There are people in Silicon Valley who are kind of tech-oriented who really like the idea. So that's one really interesting aspect of it, is that a lot of different types of political groups are curious about basic income or universal basic income. The other reason it's becoming really fascinating at this time is that several countries are really starting to tinker and experiment with the idea. So next month, June 5th, in Switzerland, there's going to be a national referendum on a universal basic income there, which is pretty wild. And then aside from that referendum, there's going to be experiments coming forth in the next year or two in several countries, in Finland, in Canada, in the Netherlands, and actually even in the United States. A Silicon Valley tech group called Y Combinator is going to test basic income. So basic income is really kind of an intriguing idea to a lot of people, and it has a really long history, as you asked. It goes back to Thomas Paine, you know, one of the founding fathers on the intellectual side, who wrote Common. He also wrote another pamphlet called Agrarian Justice, where he kind of put forth this idea that we should give every adult citizen who's 21 kind of 15 pounds sterling, and that should kind of get them started in life, and everyone would be on the same playing field. And when you look at basic income's history in a more modern sense, Martin Luther King was an advocate. The libertarian economist Milton Friedman proposed a very similar idea, believe it or not. And the Nixon administration nearly passed a kind of a watered down or a partial basic income in the late 60s, early 70s. It passed the House of Representatives, then stalled in the Senate. So there's really a fascinating history to basic income, and it's kind of an interesting idea.
And so we're here with Mr. Andrew Flowers, the quantitative editor for 538.com, talking about this idea of universal basic income. So it's not that people would be, in this scenario, they wouldn't be limited to that universal basic income. I mean, they could do with it. They could grow, that money to grow themselves, whatever. But that's just a sort of a guaranteed standard. As you say, it's some of the momentum that had, I guess, grown with Nixon and some notable economists really lost steam during the 80s with the rise of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and sort of a conservative backlash against government programs.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, if you think about, what the argument for a basic income is, it boils down to a radical change of our current welfare system. And you're right that under basic income as it's put forth now and almost always, it's not to control work. Everyone, if you're a billionaire, you get the same amount as a homeless person. And it doesn't, it's not trying to affect you in terms of your eligibility programs. And one of the big arguments for it is that, why would you want a basic income over a current welfare system? One is that, under the current welfare system, there are these welfare traps or poverty traps that people call them, which means that to be eligible for all these different types of programs, whether it's food stamps or unemployment insurance or, the earned income tax credit or the child tax credit and so on, you have to earn a certain amount of money or less. And so what that does is it acts as a disincentive to working more. There are these kind of, in technical terms, from an economist's point of view, there are these high marginal tax rates to wanting to, earn more money because you'll become ineligible for cash welfare in the United States. If you have a basic income, you kind of smooth over those incentives, and it kind of acts as kind of a baseline floor to support everyone, but without deterring them from working more. Now, the argument for basic income from the libertarian perspective, because you mentioned that, there was a backlash in the 80s with Thatcher and Reagan who wanted to kind of cut these programs. That's kind of exactly the argument for basic income, is that we have this sprawling welfare state. We have over 100 programs at the federal and state level that total over $1 trillion that we spend every year. And there's this indecipherable alphabet soup of programs, SNAP and CHIP and TANF and WIC and EITC and SSDI and Section 8 housing vouchers. And the point is, you can streamline all that bureaucracy. If instead you had different government agencies, instead of them kind of administering these one-off programs, if you just rolled all that into one, gave a check to people, and a lot of research that behind basic income says, people know how to spend their money just fine. They're going to be pretty effective at it. You don't need a government service to administer something for them.
One of the things, we're here with Andrew Flowers with 538.com about this idea of universal basic income. So something you said just a minute ago, very interesting, that there were these welfare traps that were a disincentive in some ways to work. So in other words, because one of the criticisms made against an idea like universal basic income is that will hurt the incentive to work because people will have a guaranteed income. They won't therefore be have an incentive. But so what you're saying is that there could also be a disincentive to work in the way the system is now.
Yes, exactly. So there are kind of two different economic incentive effects that we should try to disentangle when we decide between basic income or our current welfare system. One of them, we already mentioned, is this welfare trap notion, this idea of a marginal tax rates, which means, under current program, it's a deterrent to working more. Supposedly, basic income fixes that. But there's a separate disincentive effect here we got to look at closely, which is what you're suggesting. is that if we give people kind of a baseline level of income, well, what if they don't work? And, you know, in aggregate, if we gave everyone a basic income, what would be the work effects? Like, would there, how much of a decline in work hours would there be? And if it's large, have a huge effect on the economy? And the answer is like, yes, that's a very valid criticism. And so one of the interesting things about basic income is that it's been tested in some sense in past experiments. And so in the 70s and 80s, or excuse me, in the 1960s and 70s in Canada and the United States, there were five major experiments that people look to that kind of shed light on basic income today. These experiments often involved what is called a negative income tax, which is a very similar, very, very, very similar idea to a basic income, which is that instead of paying money to the government, if you earn instead below a certain income threshold, the government cuts you a check. That's kind of the inverse of your tax rate. And then if you earn above that rate, you pay taxes like a normal person. Milton Friedman proposed this. He thought it would fix these incentive effects. Well, we tested this in the United States in four different experiments and then one experiment in Canada in the 60s and 70s. And what they found from these experiments, and they were really, truly, like, pretty impressive, some of the first large-scale social experiments in U.S. history, in Canada's history. And they randomized families into control groups and treatment groups, and in the treatment families, they got a negative income tax. And they said, let's observe them over a few years, see if they stop working. Well, it was actually pretty surprising. The results show that people didn't really start working that much. There was a high decline in total hours from primary earners. So in households, the primary earner only declined their hours about 5%, which isn't much. The idea of a primary earner under a negative income tax or a basic income just quitting their job, that just really didn't happen. Now, a fair pushback on these experiments and on the whole idea is that, well, that was only over a few years. Well, what if we gave people a basic income for their lifetime? Would they really stop working? I mean, it's possible they would. And so that's why these more modern experiments that are being planned in Finland, which will be launching next year, and in the Netherlands, which will also be launching in 19 different small cities throughout the Netherlands, and then in the United States, Y Combinator has raised $20 million. They want to do Y Combinator is a startup fund instead of San Francisco, and they want to randomly give certain Americans a basic income and see how their work is affected. So these experiments will really help us answer this important criticism you're raising of, like, well, what if people stop working under a basic income?
Well, that's a fascinating idea, really, and we've only got about a minute left here. But one of the issues you raise is the shifts that are happening in our economy with the rise of automation and with people feeling probably more insecure than ever in their employment. Perhaps a universal basic income helps address that question as well.
Exactly. So one of the main reasons a lot of Silicon Valley techies or other technologists are really interested in basic income is that they fear that with automation and robots and machine learning, that the advances in technology are going to automate a lot of work. So, for example, driverless cars. A lot of people are employed as truck drivers right now in the United States. Well, what if those jobs are gone in the next, say, 20 years? A basic income.
Andrew, we're about out of time, unfortunately. That's the music. Sorry about that. Hey, listen, have a great rest of your day. Thanks for your great work.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're right at the bottom of the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show. In my question of the day on the 46th anniversary of the Kent State University shootings on May 4th, 1970, captured in film with the Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph of the young 14-year-old Marianne Vecchio leaning over the slain student, one of four to die that day, nine wounded from the National Guardsman's bullets. My question of the day is, what is the most powerful photograph, do you think, in U.S. history? And if you want to post it, you can go to the show's Facebook page, Mike Allen Show, the handle, or on Twitter, or you can email it to me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call or text 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Andrew Flowers, had my guest last segment from 538.com, has a lot on his plate today, so he couldn't stick around for a second segment. But you could sense his enthusiasm about this concept. Now, he readily admits, right, this idea of universal basic income, of giving everybody a guaranteed monthly income, basically eliminating our myriad of various social safety net acronyms and agencies, and giving everybody a set basic income within a society. Not that you're therefore limited to that amount. You can use that money, parlay it however you want, use it however you want. But this idea he readily recognizes is not that tested, and there are certainly criticisms against it and legitimate points against it. But he also says there are a lot of legitimate points for it, and there's a broad spectrum of people who support this idea. And if you want to talk about this in what you heard here, I've also posted a link to the article on the show's Facebook page if you want to check that out. He quotes, let's see, Matt Zwolinski, who is a philosophy professor at the University of San Diego and one of the most prominent libertarian advocates for basic income. He says, the money we spend on welfare will be better spent, more productive for the kind of ends we want, if we spend it through a basic income. And as he says, despite squeamishness at the idea of government handouts, some libertarians see basic income as a more efficient replacement for current social programs, one that would streamline the welfare bureaucracy and reduce costs overall. He also argues that basic income is superior on moral grounds. People could spend their money however they want. Food stamp recipients, for example, would no longer be constrained to use their benefits to buy food or even certain types of food. There's something objectionable, he says, about paternalism, treating adults as children who need to have their decisions made for them. We got Shannon calling in, wanting to weigh in on this topic. Shannon, good morning.
Yeah, you mentioned food stamps. Now, I haven't gotten in that boat. We just don't make little enough.
Right.
Yet. But I do know, just from reading other things, I do know that food stamps is under the it's under the control or the Department of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, of course, they have big agribusinesses have their hands in that, corn producers and stuff. So you are constrained, or it's sort of a food stamp idea. Not only benefits supposedly the recipients, but it also benefits agribusinesses, corn producers. It's no surprise that you find lots of corn additives, high fructose syrup, stuff like that, in breads and things that you are not only encouraged but supposed to buy on food stamps. And some of those things can be very bad for you. Ketchup, you know, all that sugar, it's not really healthy. So you find that cereals and things like that, you see, that's not really all that healthy for you, but that's what you're supposed to buy on food stamps. So anyway, the whole idea that government tells you what's healthy and what's not healthy and what you can buy is kind of a constraint on your freedom to do the right thing and the best thing for your family with, you know, so-called free money. But my other question was, and of course he's not on the line anymore, but I thought, the first thing when he was describing the experiments that have been done in the past sort of sounded like earned income credit. Wouldn't that, don't you think that might tell us something about people's the disincentive or incentive to work? I mean, if you're working and you're not making quite enough, you can get a negative income tax through the earned income credit on your tax. Of course, you really do have to make a little bit, but you know what I'm saying? You have to work. And then there was some making work credit or something a few years ago when the recession had hit.
Yeah, I don't.
Income tax return, but that went out with, you know, budget, with the budget reconciliations and stuff like that. I mean, every year, I guess they put things in or take things out of the Internal Revenue Code, but for a few years, you were able to use that credit to, to offset some losses and stuff. But anyway, I just thought that those were modern ideas that could tell us about whether it's true that people will just stop working. I mean, I can't imagine there's good things to get from working. But who in their right mind wants to work 80 hours a week in order to eke out a modest living? That's just...
Well, one of the things...
I hope I don't sound too social.
No, and... Pinko! Yeah,
please,
it's funny because, you know, I see an article like this.
Don't send me hate mail.
I read an article like this, Shannon, and I kind of transport myself back to back in the early 90s when I was having to drive back and forth to school about 40 minutes each way. And so I would oftentimes find myself listening to Rush Limbaugh, right? And so I was, you know, my sister gave me a subscription to the Limbaugh Letter. And, you know, of course, an idea like this to, you know, the Limbaugh mind would be just horrific, right? Because this is just freeloading. This is welfare queens and all the rest. But you read the article and you see, again, don't just dismiss an argument until you've considered it on its merits. A wide variety of people who support this idea. We already have a social safety net. I think I would argue certainly compatible with Catholic social teaching and that sort of thing. But then to read about, you know, getting past the caricatures of what would happen if you gave people money. And yes, there would be some who would succumb to the worst angels of their nature, I guess. But there are others who would
be a freeloader.
There would be others who would perhaps use it as an opportunity to further their education, you know, or to get out of a particular line of work and learn some sort of a new skill or trade. And one of the other points he makes in here too is that, you know, we have this almost fear of automation now, and oh man, are we going to replace all our McDonald's workers with, you know, with touch screens in which people place their own orders and all that sort of thing? This would kind of grease the wheels for that because you wouldn't need those type of jobs. So you know, to give some people something to do productive, you give them this income, they can perhaps creatively.
Education,
and look into other things.
I guess that's what he was getting at. That sort of link between that time to carry you through that, where you can develop your new skills or whatever. That and it makes sense, you know, that you don't have to rely on getting too poor in order to afford or to qualify for food stamps and. Those sorts of things. There was something else that happened. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's gone viral. This reaction this one woman had to it was on Fox. It came up on my Facebook. But this woman had to a gentleman. They both had children. They're in Walmart, and he used food stamps to buy some food, and she just took it upon herself to just say what she thought about that and how tired she was of people like him taking money from her. And all this, you know, that I think that's another thing, a universal income. Well, maybe that will lessen the threats that people feel by others using a hand up instead of a hand out. You know, they won't feel like they're being stolen from. Maybe they'll feel like they'll understand how it's actually helpful to many people. It was just... the times are really, people are really losing their civility, I think, and compassion for others who we don't know the worst things that people have to put up with. You know, it's just, and then the election. I just really worried and pray for our country at this time. It's just really a sad, scary time.
I agree with you. You know, this ties in a little bit, too, to some of the things that we talked about yesterday in terms of the economic insecurity that a lot of people feel right now. And, you know, that's much more prevalent, I think, than we even realize. And, you know, it seems obvious to me the system as it is right now is not working. Right. So
no.
We got to
look at something that takes the best of many economic philosophies and for the better of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Shannon,
the idea shouldn't be shouldn't rest on winners and losers. The winners succeed on the losers' backs. I think that's a definite definitely leave that idea out. And it seems like a lot of times that's how things work around here.
Hmm. Well, I strongly encourage everybody to read the article because I think it's a fascinating one. And Shannon, always appreciate the call. Blessings to you, okay? All right.
You too. Thanks.
So check out the article I've posted on the show's Facebook page from 538.com, Andrew Flowers, What Would Happen If We Just Gave People Money. As has been said, the market economy is great, but let's take it to another level, perhaps, and recognize the inherent flaws that are there that need to be addressed. We'll be back. You can certainly call in 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to get your thoughts known. We'll be back in a minute. We'll spin the Dollar Catechism wheel, among other things. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Everybody gathered where the river runs wider at the edge of town, to see if that Eddie Lee Vaughn baptism was really gonna go down. Folks bet hard-earned money that water wouldn't change a thing. They set the odds at 100-1 his soul would never come clean. Then the preacher said, people, take a moment or two. There's something we need to do. Pray for the fish. They won't know what's coming when the sand starts rolling off the likes of him. Lord, be with them. They ain't done nothing. Please, won't you leave them just a little bit of room to swim? Pray for the fish.
15 minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Happy birthday to Mr. Randy Travis, 57 years old. I'm not sure that he's not, Randy Travis is pretty young, actually. Believe me, my definition of young has changed considerably over the years now that I've turned 50. But Randy Travis, you see how young he was when he got started. But this song, I'm not sure it ever made the radio, Pray for the Fish. I use it every year with my sacraments class that I teach at our local Catholic high school because it's sort of a playful song on the efficacy of baptism, meaning baptism not just a symbol, as it is maybe in some Christian communions, but in the Catholic understanding, baptism actually does something. It accomplishes what it signifies. Now, we don't literally believe the sins are in the water so that the fish are crowded out. But we do believe that, just like in the Carrie Underwood song, must be something in the water, that God actually works through baptism. It's not just a sign of what's already happened. Through that matter, God, in some mysterious way, does an invisible grace through that visible sign. So happy birthday, Randy Travis. Thanks for giving me part of a lesson for my sacraments class. Always looking for something. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. If you've got to chime in on this whole issue of universal basic income, this interview that I had with Andrew Flowers and the article that he wrote that I've posted on the show's Facebook page, What Would Happen If We Just Gave People Money? Now, I believe me, I understand the skepticism. I've got it myself. I couldn't help but think a little bit of that old Jimmy Carter impression by Dan Aykroyd. Going back a ways now to Saturday Night Live in the 70s, the time of rampant inflation, and Dan Aykroyd, as Jimmy Carter, said, inflation is our friend. And he talked about, we'll just print more money. Everybody will be a millionaire. By the way, I thought of another Saturday Night Live skit when I saw this story from ABCNews.com. Alligator caught on video attempting to ring doorbell of South Carolina home. An alligator was recently caught scratching at the front door of a South Carolina's family home as if it were attempting to ring the doorbell. Evidently, he was trying to make an attempt to get over the fence and into this woman's pool in the backyard, but decided, I guess, he'd go to the front door. Boy, how terrifying would that be? Ding dong! It kind of reminded, so like I said, another Saturday Night Live skit, that of the land shark, Candy Graham. Now the gator, I mean, I know gators can be a problem, okay? When they're coming to your front door, posing as delivery men, that's when we know we're in real trouble. 573-4BREAD-4, you want to chime in? 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Maybe it's my own financial insecurity that makes me want a universal basic income. Like I said, I'm looking for that that secret government account that lots of other people seem to be drawn from. I am getting a new washer and dryer today, though, so in that regard, I'll be a rich man. Today, this month, of course, dedicated to the veneration of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the month of Mary in Catholic tradition. A great column here from the National Catholic Register by Marge Fenelon. She said, having gone to a Catholic grade school run by the Schoenstatt Sisters of Mary, my early childhood memories include honoring Mary during May, a practice I've continued all of my life and taught my children to do as well. It's as natural and essential to me as my morning coffee, but far, far more joy-filled, if you can even imagine that. Then she asked the question, why is May Mary's month? She says, here's a brief explanation. For centuries, the Catholic Church has set aside the entire month of Mary to honor May, to honor Mary, Mother of God. Not just a day in May, but the entire month. The custom spans both centuries and cultures, with roots going back as far as the ancient Greeks. In early Greece, May was dedicated to Artemis, the goddess of fecundity. Fecundity, fertility. Fecundity needs to make a comeback. My, that's a fecund woman. Anyway, in ancient Rome, May was dedicated to Flora, the goddess of blooms or blossoms. They celebrated ludi florals or floral games at the end of April and asked the intercession of Flora and all that blooms. In medieval times, similar customs abounded, all centering around the practice of expelling winter, as May 1st was considered the start of new growth. So here we have perhaps another example of what the Catholic Church has done so readily throughout the centuries, is to take the best of pagan practices and to redeem them. And again, this is rooted a bit in what we talked about earlier with St. Paul at Mars Hill, looking at all these statues to the various gods in the city of Athens, being initially exasperated at their belief in a multiplicity of gods, and then recognizing it as a point of connection, an opportunity to bring the gospel, because the understanding is, and this has a long history in the Catholic faith, is that there are traces of truth in every culture and religious system, and that much of it points ahead to the fulfillment of those desires in the supreme truth who is a person, Jesus Christ. And so it's fair game to take some of these cultural practices that perhaps unknowingly pointed ahead to their fulfillment in Christ and to use them. And so perhaps these ancient the ancient dedication of the month of May to Greek or to Roman gods or goddesses makes perfect sense then to be dedicated to the one who is the queen of heaven and earth. I always think it's important when we talk about May crownings and the crowning of Mary and so forth, which really makes some Protestant Christians uncomfortable. What do we mean when we call Mary the queen of angels and saints? Are we saying that she's a queen on par with Jesus and his royal kingship? Not at all. We are simply taking seriously the promise all through the New Testament that we share in Christ's glory. I always compare it, and I know I've said this before, but I never tire of making the connection with the first Narnia movie, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or if you've read the book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and how at the end of that, after defeating the White Witch, of course, with Aslan's help, but after defeating the White Witch, the four children, the two sons of Adam and the two daughters of Eve, Peter, Edmund, Susan, and Lucy, all are crowned there in the palace in front of all the other citizens of Narnia, and there's great rejoicing. Never once is there any sort of assumption that the crowns that they received are make them on par with Aslan or are owed simply to their own merits. But it's in the gratuitous and condescending kindness of Aslan, the true king, that makes possible their sharing in his royal crown. It's the same with the Blessed Mother. And with all the saints, we will receive our own crowns, God willing, one day. But Mary, because of her particular and singular role in her fiat, in undoing through her obedience the disobedience of Eve and receiving into her very body the incarnate Son of God, she is considered the queen of angels and saints, but only by God's grace, just so you know. So Mary, pray for us. Anyway, I want to spin this Dollar Catechism wheel. Let's go to this great repository of the faith. Dial up a number between 1 and 2865. See what Providence has in store. Paragraph 90. Very early in the section on the creed. The dogmas of the faith. The mutual connections between dogmas and their coherence can be found in the whole of the revelation of the mystery of Christ. In Catholic doctrine, there exists an order or hierarchy of truths, since they vary in their relation to the foundation of the Christian faith. So this is where we have to get past our resistance to the word dogma. We hear dogma and we think something rigid and unyielding and harsh and legalistic. That's really not what dogma is. Dogma actually says in the paragraph before this in the Catechism, they are lights along the path of faith. They illuminate it and make it secure. And of course, as we said, there is a mutual connection, a coherence. It's like a great Jenga tower. The truths of the faith hang together and hold together. And there is a hierarchy, a sacred order of truths in which they all fit together. That's really the basis for why we play the Dollar Catechism game. We're going to let Bill Murray take us out on this May 4th. May the 4th be with you. Happy Star Wars Day. Mary, pray for us. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great rest of your day. We'll let Bill Murray take us out.
Star Wars. If they should fire wars, please let these Star Wars stay. And hey, how about that nutty Star Wars bar? Can you forget all the creatures in there? And hey, Darth Vader in that black and evil mask.